Tonight's topic is about intention. What's your intention for 2016? And this seems like a timely topic, considering that we're on the cusp of a new year. So I thought what we could talk about is what's the difference between intention and a resolution? Because we hear a lot about New Year's resolutions. So we'll kind of explore that a little bit. And, you know, what is a New Year's resolution? What is an intention? We're going to explore what the Buddha said about intention. And he had a lot to say. It's actually one of the Eightfold Path, is intention. And then we're going to talk about how to set it mindfully. Where is that intention coming from? So, New Year's resolutions. Who does them? Does anybody here set New Year's resolutions?
Not resolutions exactly, but...
Yeah?
Yeah, resolutions.
Well, those of you who set them, how long do they last?
3 days.
How long do most New Year's resolutions last? Why is that, you suppose?
Because life happens.
Life happens. What else? Not invested in them, possibly.
Expecting something to happen.
Okay. All right. Well, here's some New Year's resolutions that I read about online. My New Year's resolution is to stop lying to myself about making lifestyle changes. My New Year's resolution is to make better bad decisions. My New Year's resolution is to stop correcting your terrible spelling and focus more on your horrific grammar. That one's a little close to home for me, being a former English teacher. And my New Year's resolution is to stop hanging out with people who ask me about my New Year's resolution. So anyway, perhaps yours are a little bit more practical, but... I mean, I actually looked in the dictionary or online and to get a definition of resolution, and it says it's a firm decision to do or not to do something. Pretty straightforward. But it's basically involved, it's based on a decision. You know, we make a decision that we're going to change something, but what's the decision based on? We make decisions in life all the time. Where do they come from? Do they come from anger or fear or shame or guilt, peer pressure, a subpoena? You know, why do we make the choices we make? Why do we make the decisions we make? And where do these resolutions come from? What's your intention? So I looked up the definition of intention. And it was purpose or attitude toward the effect of one's actions or conduct. Purpose or attitude towards the effect of someone's actions or conduct. So purpose or attitude. So attitude's an interesting word, and we're going to explore that a little bit more. So, you know, your goal, your purpose, your aim is your intention. It's something you mean to do, whether you pull it off or not. So, for example, you may have the best intention of cooking an amazing meal, but then you leave the burner on when you're gone and you burn the house down. Will you be remembered as an excellent chef? When a father asks his daughter's boyfriend, "What's your intention?" What is he saying? Are you going to marry my daughter? So, you know, where is your purpose, your goal, your aim, and your attitude and your intention come from? So we're going to explore this. And what I'm going to ask that you do is you pair off with someone. Now, you don't have to, I want to make this easy. You don't have to face this person. You can kind of be near this person because you're going to have some intermittent conversations, brief conversations. And I'm going to ask that you do not pair off someone with someone who you're in a relationship with, intimate relationship. Pick someone that maybe you don't know quite as well, all right? So if you would go ahead and pick someone that you're going to work with, and you're going to need to be sitting near them, next to them. So Mark, you may need to move.
Yes.
Okay. If you would, please. Who needs a partner?
Yeah.
You can move over there?
Yeah.
Great. All right. So Margaret's got something she's going to hand out. Now, I need your attention for a moment. So she's got something that she's going to put in your hand. Now, you don't have to eat it. So if you don't do sugar, don't worry about it. You don't have to eat it. But even if you're not going to eat it, I ask that you take, and you can, and, you know, and she's going to put them in your hand. Put two or three. And unless you know that you're not going to eat it, and then only take, then just hold up one finger. I mean, I know some people just do not do sugar. And there's definitely sugar in this. So just hold it in your hand. Don't eat it yet. Because we're going to explore this, because in your hand is a metaphor for life. You thought this was just a peanut M&M. But in your hand is a metaphor of how you live life and the decisions that you make.
Yeah, if anybody's allergic, yeah, be aware, peanuts are there.
Yeah. So, and they're guaranteed not to melt in your hand. That's right on the package, right?
Oh, yeah?
They'll melt in your mouth, but not in your hand. That's what they say. So, okay, so what we have here is the human experience. And we're going to start. It would be nice if I had a little whiteboard or chart that, so I could draw. But what's at the center of this M&M?
Peanut.
The peanut, right? So since this is a metaphor for life, we're going to let the peanut represent the center of ourselves. And, you know, we're going to be sort of nonpartisan or non-sectarian here and just call it our values. Because I think at the center of each of us, we have some basic values. I'm not talking about surface values, like we value a nice house or a car or a wardrobe or a nice Buddha statue or something like that. I'm talking about values that we came into life with. Values like honesty, trust, caring, giving. These are values that are really connected to life itself. And a baby is born, I believe, with these values inherent within them. Now, we don't see this in the world, but we'll get to that, you see? But, I mean, if you think about a baby, isn't it true that a baby just trusts everyone, pretty much, right? They don't care about your skin color, your religion, your sexuality, your politics. You know, they'll let you pick them up and hold them, right? They give, you know. You give them some food and they'll turn around and offer it to you. They trust. They get, and they're honest. Children are really, really honest, sometimes to our own, you know, discomfort. Anybody remember the Art Linkletter show?
Oh, yeah.
Kids say the darndest thing, and he would ask these kids questions and they would just be honest. And I can imagine their parents watching on TV being mortified, because kids just say things that are honest. You know, they'll look at you and go, why is your hair like that? Or what's that on your face? Or, you know, stuff like that. So this is something that, and it doesn't matter what the culture is. You can go anywhere in the world, and every child is like this. So, and this is still inside us, but it's covered up with something. So let's look again at the, and think of the M&M. You got the peanut. What surrounds the peanut? Go ahead, say it.
Chocolate.
Chocolate. Right? The brown stuff. The BS. That's what BS stands for, is brown stuff. So again, this is a metaphor. So what we're going to represent the brown stuff, the chocolate layer, is going to represent our attitudes and our belief systems. Right? Now, attitudes and belief systems are how we look at life. This is our projections about life. So picture this little kid again, right? And core values, honesty, trust, giving. But through life, they start developing belief systems and attitudes that start covering this up. And I'll give you an example of how this might work. And so we're going to talk about a little boy named Johnny. So Johnny, you know, he comes into this life just like all of us, you know, with these core values. And he's growing up at home and he's just being treated well. And he's, you know, retains love and trust and giving. And then finally he gets to 5 years old and it's time to go to kindergarten. So I'm going to tell this little narrative from the standpoint of what it was like for me to go to kindergarten. When I went there, they had these things called cloakrooms. Mm-hmm. Do they still have cloakrooms now?
You know, cubbies.
You go in and there's a little room and there's, I guess, cubbies, right? Well, that morning before he went to school, Johnny's mom packed his lunch. And she made him this delicious peanut butter and jelly sandwich, or maybe it was hummus and cucumber. And then she put a piece of fruit in, you know, and then she put a Twinkie. Well, Johnny really likes Twinkies, right? So Johnny knows the Twinkie's in there. So all morning long, as he's sitting there in the classroom, he's thinking, Twinkie, oh, I get to have my Twinkie at lunchtime. So, you know, and he put his lunchbox up in the cubby when he came in the morning. So at lunchtime, he goes out, he pulls his lunchbox down, he opens it up, and guess what? The Twinkie's gone. Did this happen to you?
Must have something like that.
Twinkie's gone. Somebody ripped off Johnny's Twinkie. What happened to Johnny's level of trust? Does he trust everybody now? So this is what happens to us as we grow up, is now that trust, that core peanut value, is starting to cover up with a belief system. And he might start thinking, I can't trust people. Love. We just love people. And then we start being impacted by what goes on around us, what we're taught, certain religious beliefs, for example. And then perhaps the love starts shifting to hate. Trust turns to distrust. Giving, just wanting to give, now starts turning to taking. And honesty doesn't pay. So, you know, these are the kind of things that will happen as we grow up. And so what covers the brown stuff on the peanut, on the peanut M&M? Look at the M&M. What's on the outside?
Candy.
The thin candy shell. All right. Well, the peanut represented our values. The chocolate represented our belief systems. And the thin candy shell represents our behavior. Now, that's a very thin shell. And what's true is that with us, our behaviors reflect our belief systems and our attitudes. How we carry ourselves and conduct ourselves in the world is a reflection of how we look at the world. Does it reflect our values? Maybe, maybe not. And if you really want to know what the belief systems of the world are, the behaviors reflect the belief systems, and if you want to know what the belief systems are, just turn on the news. Just go to the internet and see what's happening in the world. So, you know, Johnny continues to grow up. And, you know, first of all, he had his Twinkie ripped off, right? And now he walks into a convenience store when he's older. And he decides he wants to buy a Twinkie. And he gives, how much does a Twinkie go for anyway? I haven't bought one forever.
50 cents
maybe. So he goes to the clerk, hands the Twinkie, and the Twinkie and the clerk says, that's going to be 55 cents. There's tax, right? So Johnny gives the clerk a five, And the clerk gives him back change for a 10. And Johnny just takes it and stuffs it in his pocket. What's the belief system that he has that it's okay now to do this? What are some of the things he would say to himself to justify this? Come on.
I've been cheated in the past.
I've been cheated. Yeah, I deserve it.
It's a big company. They won't miss it.
They won't miss it. His mistake, right? Or he's New Age or he's Buddhist. It's just karma ripening. Right? It's my good karma ripening. So this is what happens. And so what I'd like you to do is just dialogue with your partner for a minute about where your belief systems get in the way of you really coming from your core values that you have inside you of trust and honesty and giving, your Buddha nature. Just going to give you 2 minutes, just dialogue, conversation, just talk with your, where are your belief systems and behavior, because behavior always reflects belief systems, where it doesn't sync up with your values. So go ahead. Okay, go ahead and finish up your sentence. So as I was mentioning before, if you look around the world and you see what's happening in the world with human behavior, I think a lot of this is the fact that so many people are operating out of their behavior as a reflection of belief systems and attitudes that are not in sync with their behavior. And in my personal experience, the people that I've met who had the greatest impact on me, the people who have personal power, are those whose behavior, belief systems, and core values are all aligned. That's what I think of as congruency. To me, that's congruency. Margaret taught a yoga class today, and afterwards, one of the students was very complimentary to her. And she's going to get a little embarrassed now. That's okay. It won't last forever. But he said that he goes to a lot of classes. He said it was the best class he had ever been in. And we talked about this. Now, she has skills as a teacher. There's no question, and experience. But what was it that we agreed that he picked up on, Margaret? And go ahead and say it.
Presence.
It's presence. Mm-hmm. Her presence. Because what she was teaching out of is how she lives, you see. And that's when we listen to talks and people impact us, there's that congruency. There's that personal power. And I think the problem with New Year's resolutions not working is that people want to change their behavior and they don't look at the belief systems and the attitudes. They say, well, I'm going to drop 20 pounds or I'm going to stop doing this or I'm going to start doing that. And they don't look at what's their attitude. What's their belief system? What's their real intention? They just want to make a behavior shift and it doesn't work that way. That's why by February or March, most resolutions are all shot to hell. So anyway, you've been holding on to these M&Ms. If you want to, you can take a bite and check and see if you have any values.
I'm an empty shell.
Empty shell. But do with them as you wish. And what I want to do is talk now about what the Buddha had to say. And now it's interesting, I mentioned before that the Buddha talked about intention, and he talked about it in the context of the Eightfold Path. So let's just review a little bit. The Buddha said that what he really taught, the only thing he taught, was the cause of suffering and the cessation of suffering. And that's what was laid out in the Four Noble Truths. In the first three Noble Truths, he talks about the cause of suffering, the fact that there's relief for suffering, and there's a way out. In the Eightfold Path, is the way out. He was very clear about it. And in the 45 years of his teaching, he basically was teaching out of the Eightfold Path. So if we look at them, there's right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Now, right doesn't mean like right, wrong. It's more like correct or intentional. You know, it's more like, there's another word I'm looking for. Help me if you know what
it works.
Skillful?
Skillful. Yeah, more like skillful. Thank you. So now it's interesting that the Eightfold Path is divided up in three areas. Three of the Eightfold Path are in the area of concentration, or samadhi, as it was used in Pali. Three of them are in the role of ethics, or sila. And two of them are in wisdom, or panya. So, for example, right view and right intention, the first two are in the wisdom category. Right speech, right action, and right livelihood are in the ethics or sila. And then the last three, effort, mindfulness, and concentration, are in the samadhi or concentration area. Now, the way the Buddha talked about it, it's not like you do the first one and then the second and the third. It's not linear. And then when you get to number eight, you're graduated and you get the secret password and the handshake and the t-shirt and all that. It's an ongoing process, and you can look at it like, I've heard it expressed like an eight-lane highway, like you're navigating all of these different processes. You've heard this several times, haven't you, Vicky? We've talked about this.
Yeah, that's good.
You heard my shtick. And you move back and forth because they all work together, right? Or you can look at it as a wheel, you know? You've got ethics, wisdom, and concentration, and you can go like a cycle. You can look at it like a three-legged stool, all supporting your practice. You can look at it as a house where actually the ethics are the foundation. Because if you don't have good ethical practices, then you have troubled mind. You know, if you're ripping off people, it's hard, you know, living an unethical life. That's an impure mind, impure thoughts. It's going to be difficult to develop concentration. Is that a kid or a cat?
It's a cat.
Cat. It's going to be difficult to develop concentration, right? Unless your mind is calm based on your behavior. And you can't really develop deep insight and wisdom unless you have some part of concentration, right? So this is kind of how the Eightfold Path is. Well, what's interesting is that intention is placed in the wording between view and the next three steps, which are all ethics. So let's take a look at that. So the way the Buddha said was, okay, we've got view and then we've got intention. So even though it's not linear, he's saying right view is very important. So let's talk about right view a little bit. Right view, or skillful view, or correct view, is understanding how things are. Seeing things in their true nature. And it's not just an intellectual understanding, it's an experiential understanding. It's not just looking at a menu and knowing that the food's good. You don't know if the food's good unless you taste it, right? That's the experience. So people can talk about how things are. People talk about impermanence, right? Anicca. There's a difference between reading it and going, oh yeah, that makes sense, but actually experiencing impermanence, experiencing it in the meditation, right? Watching the arising and passing of every experience, watching the thoughts come up, we note them, they pass away, we come back to our breath, right? Noticing sensations, noticing emotions, noticing sounds, noticing anger arise, but we watch it, it passes away. This is an experiential understanding of impermanence. So I think most of you, maybe all of you, are familiar with the Zen teacher Thich Nhat Hanh. This is what he said about right view. He said, our happiness and our happiness of those around us depend on our degree of right view. Touching reality deeply, knowing what's going on inside and outside of ourselves, is the way to liberate ourselves from the suffering that's caused by wrong perceptions. Right view is not an ideology or a system or even a path. It's an insight we have into the reality of life. A living insight that fills us with understanding, peace, and love. So if we have that kind of insight into how life is, how much does that help us developing good intention? Because we're developing good intention with an understanding of how things work. It's like cleaning off the glasses. You know, every once in a while I go, oh man, you know, now I got better vision. I got clearer view. And this practice clears our vision, right? I studied with a teacher in California named Reb Anderson. This was at a Zen center. And one time there were a whole bunch of students in this room. And Reb said, you know the difference between us in this room and all the people out there? The difference is that even though we're all delusional, we know we're delusional. We get that. We understand that we're delusional, that we have conditioned mind, and we're working with it. We're out there, it's just the walking dead for the most part. He wasn't saying that in a judgmental way. He was just pointing out, you know, this is, you know, the difference of having right view or not. So, out of right view, then we have right intention. So it's the second factor in the Eightfold Path. It's called Sama Sankappa, which means right intention. And it's also sometimes referred to as right thought. Sometimes when you see the Eightfold Path laid out, instead of intention, they'll have right thought. Because there is a cognitive aspect to it, right? There is a thought process in developing intention. And it's also sometimes called right attitude. Well, there's that attitude word again, right? So thought is the forerunner of action. It directs body and speech. And before we say anything, we have an intention, whether we're mindful of it or not. The Buddha said in the Dhammapada that our thoughts are the forerunner of our actions. Actions always point back to the thoughts from which they spring. Gee, would that have something similar to do with our behavior always reflecting our attitudes and belief systems? Maybe there's some similarity there. Our behavior always reflects our thoughts, our intention. And that is a reflection of our view, how we look at things. Are we looking at things with pure view? So directing wholesome intentions is developing mindfulness, not only concerning our intentions, but how we can build ethical behavior based on that. Because again, right after right intention was speech, action, and livelihood, the three aspects of sila, or ethical behavior. So if we have clear view, right view, and we have good intention, what's our action going to be? Is it going to be pure? Right speech, right action, right livelihood, honesty, giving, trust, it's those same core values. The Buddha explained right intention as being threefold. He said the first one is the intention of renunciation. Now, renunciation is a word that kind of gets a bad knock. You know, as soon as you hear the word renunciation, we think, well, I got to shave my head, wear robes, give away everything I own, and go begging for food with a bowl. No, it just means a lack of desire, a willingness to let go of craving, right? So he said that's one aspect of intention, is giving up that, desire. He said the unenlightened who follow the path of desire get caught in that flow, and they're constantly pursuing objects in which they imagine they're going to find fulfillment. Now, we all, I think, would know we have some kind of understanding that money's not going to buy happiness. And the Buddha taught just the opposite. It's that pull of desire that we need to let go of, you know, that there's nothing morally evil about wanting certain things, but it's the root of suffering. It's that craving. It's the cause. So turning away from that craving is the process of renunciation. The second that he said was part of right intention was the intention of goodwill as opposed to ill will. So it's thoughts govern, you know, ill will are thoughts governed by anger and aversion. So the Buddha's primary antidote to ill will was, anybody want to guess what his primary antidote? We did it earlier.
Loving
kindness. The Buddha's antidote to ill will was loving kindness. And he taught this over and over and over again. And we've probably experienced this. I've had experiences where people have done things and I felt anger started arising. And if I just could remember to do metta. Some of you might have heard of the story about the guy on the motorcycle who gave me the finger because he didn't like my bumper stickers. And as he was pulling away, instead of reacting, at that time I had the awareness. I did metta for him. May you be safe. May you arrive, you know, may you be happy. May you arrive safely, this kind of thing, rather than, you know, which is like, that's old, it's ill will, right? So it's that feeling of selfless love radiating outwards. The third part of intention that he talked about was harmlessness, obviously, as opposed to harmfulness. And these are thoughts guided by compassion, aroused in opposition to cruel or aggressive to violent thoughts. And compassion complements loving kindness. Loving kindness has the characteristic of wishing for the happiness and welfare of others. And compassion has the characteristic of wishing others are free from suffering. Now, I want to say that sometimes you'll see loving kindness and compassion taught as like they're the same thing. Well, they're pretty close. But loving kindness is an intention of love for others, and compassion is wanting others to be free from suffering. It's very close, but there is a small distinction. So, you know, you can see where if we're letting go of craving, when we set our intention, if we are generating thoughts of goodwill and thoughts of harmlessness, wouldn't it be a little easier to set intentions? So what I would like you to do is talk with your partner now about thoughts about what you might want to create in 2016. You've probably already entertained some thoughts, is my hunch. Most of you have had some thoughts about to just talk a little bit about what are some of the things that you'd like to show up in your life in 2016, what some of your intentions might be. So I'll give you 2 or 3 minutes to talk about that. Go ahead. So there's some, I almost hate to, there's so much good energy in the sharing, but I do want to wrap it up and then open it up for group sharing and have some time for that. And there's one more piece I want to bring to this, and that's about how to approach this with what kind of attitude about how do I create intentions. And Margaret offered something that I thought was really interesting, and we were talking about it, and you know, sometimes there's a certain kind of pressure or expectation that we're supposed to have, you know, make resolutions and all this kind of stuff. Well, I got to have goals for 2016. And sometimes it goes deeper in that, where we think we have to find our purpose in life. Oh my God, I haven't found my purpose in life yet. You know, I remember when I read Joseph Campbell, I love Joseph Campbell. And remember that famous phrase he said? He said, follow your bliss, right? And I went, oh, shit, I don't know what my bliss is. I'm in trouble, you know? And I'm like, frantic. I got to find my bliss. What's my purpose, you know? And what I found out, what worked was I had to just let it come to me. It had to come to me. I can't force it. But a lot of times we put pressure on ourselves. And so what Margaret was saying is, you know, how different an approach it is just to be curious, just to sort of have a curiosity, which is, to me, it's a shift. It's a gentler approach. There's no pressure. There's no, critical eye, like, oh, my God, I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing or what my goals are and stuff. So ask yourself the question, you know, am I willing to just investigate, just to be open, just to kind of explore, kind of let it come to me? Just being open to possibilities. And I think in my experience, when that happens, I'm more aware of the subtler messages. You know, if I'm pushing, I miss things. I'm trying to force something. And maybe you've had this experience where you've just kind of taken a softer, more curious approach. Margaret and I co-host a radio show on Monday nights on a local community radio, and each week we have a guest on. And by the way, Rania was our first guest, and I just was now able to get the show up, the archive show. So we'll get some information out so people can go back and listen to that. And Michael is going to be on this coming Monday.
Is it on the website?
It we'll get it on the website. We'll get the link so you can, you know. It's been a learning curve for me.
Yeah.
Right. But we had a guest on, and this guy, he's a PhD. He's a licensed clinical addiction specialist. He's an RN. He's a massage therapist. He's a minister. He's a master of holotropic breathing. He's got all these letters. I've never seen a guy with so many letters after his name. So we said to him, how did you get all, that's a lot of letters to get after his name. And his response was very simple. He said, I was just really curious.
Yeah.
Wow. I thought, what a great attitude. Yeah.
No ego about it.
Not really.
Curious.
Yeah, just a curiosity. And what's interesting is that when I do yoga practice, I'm also invited to just be curious about what's in my body. What's going on? What are my sensations? When we do meditation, it's the same approach. Watch what arises. We follow our breath. A thought comes up, a sound, something pulls us away. We just notice, right? What was that? Just notice and come back. It's the same kind of approach. It's like a meditation in life. Just watching what's arising, what's happening. And to me, that really gets me in touch with what's inside, my intuition. I can really hear that voice, what's calling me. So what I'd like to do is open it up for discussion. We've got a few minutes left.